Welcome to the N of One Collaborative Fireside Chats in Individualized Medicine. My name is Nicole Nolan, and I am the Operations Manager. It's my pleasure to introduce the moderator of today's episode, Dr. Scott Demarest of the University of Colorado. Scott, please take it away.
Thanks, Nicole, and I appreciate the invitation to be here. I'm a pediatric neurologist and epileptologist and have been engaged and connected to the N of One space and rare disease and precision medicine more broadly for the better part of a decade now. And I'm really excited to be able to moderate a fantastic group. And we'll kick it off with some introductions. And I'll invite Tim Yu. Nobody knows who you are. Could you please start with the initial introduction for us?
Thank you, Scott. Scott, it's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Tim Yu. I'm a neurologist and geneticist at Boston Children's Hospital. And as it turns out, together with Scott, we had the pleasure of running what people have referred to as the first of the modern N of One trials back in 2018 on behalf of a patient with a rare condition called Dutt disease. Who was treated with the patient-customized medicine, for which she was the only patient in the world for whom the drug was applicable. Hence the term N of One drug, N of One trial. So pleasure to kind of continue to discuss this topic with you and colleagues who will introduce themselves next.
Thanks, Tim. Olivia Kim McManus, could you maybe introduce yourself now?
Sure. Thanks for having me. My name is Olivia Kim McManus. I'm also a pediatric neurologist and epileptologist. I'm at UC San Diego Neurosciences and part of the Rady Children's Institute for Genomic Medicine. I direct our Batten's disease clinic at Rady's and on PI for NF1, current NF1 trials with antisense oligo in a patient with SCN2A and other upcoming genetic variants. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Olivia, and we're glad you're here. Richard Finkel, last but certainly not least.
Thanks, Scott. Richard Finkel, I'm a pediatric neurologist, and I work at the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, where I direct the Center for Experimental Neurotherapeutics. And within that program, we have a personalized medicine program that we're developing and trying to address NFU opportunities. So I've been fortunate to been able to contribute to some of the activities of the N1 Collaborative as it relates to selection of diseases and genetic variants that might be amenable to ASO treatment and how to address patient outcomes by looking at clinical outcome assessments and biomarkers.
Wonderful. And we're glad you're here with us. So maybe we can all start with the basics here. Tim alluded to this a little bit in his introduction, but I wanted to start with how do we define an N of one? What really is an N of one? And I'll leave these questions generally open to all three of you, and you can decide how you want to jump in.
I can speak on this since we recently published about what we defined as N of one here. And we're talking about investigational genetic therapies where the actual drug itself is individualized to a single subject who's in trial with a genetic variant amenable to ASO or other gene therapies, not just ASO. Mm-hmm. And this is where we would outcome measures and safety measures are all tailored to the individual gene as the variant, the causal variant, as well as the phenotype.
And I would add to what Olivia just said by mentioning that there might be a single patient that we see in clinic that drives the discussion. And there may, in fact, be other individuals out there with that same variant. But at the moment, we're focused on that one individual in front of us in clinic. Or it may be that there's a single patient identified in ClinVar or some other database, and it's particularly amenable to a gene-targeted treatment such as an ASO. So we might be focusing on the gene variant in one case, and we might be focusing on a individual patient in another case. But knowing that these could potentially expand over time beyond that single patient.
So if they could expand, sort of what are the borders around N of one? So because I'm hearing N of one slash N of few. How do we define when we're kind of in that range and when we're starting to get out of that range?
This is a great and arguably sort of intermediate or advanced level topic within the N of ones, but I'll take a first stab at it. I'll say that let's start with the simplest case, which is that it is really truly an individual patient, there are certain challenges and opportunities that are attendant with the fact that you're focusing on an individual patient. One of the challenges is that these are programs that, because they're not meant for large market indications, they don't have the resources behind them that, say, a traditional company would have be able to bring to bear to do extensive years of clinical testing and design of the molecule, optimizing manufacturing, even necessarily optimizing the most comprehensive set of safety studies. Instead, these are programs that are built for patients with really usually advanced and or rapidly progressing diseases that are very debilitating and often lethal. So they're run under considerable time pressure. What that means is that you have to make choices that are wise and expedient to make a drug in time so that it's actually relevant for the participant. Or the small numbers of participants that we're talking about. It also means that you are have limited time to design a clinical trial or to collect the history of the patient and their baseline trajectory. So those are some of the challenges that we kind of face in this. Getting to your original question, which I said was maybe intermediate or advanced, right? At some point, when does an N of one trial become an N of two or N of five, or sometimes an N of 10 or N of 20, we have to, we should say up front that there's a gray area here, and that there are genetically targeted drugs that are effectively orphan in the sense that there's a drug that's out there that might work for maybe it's one, maybe it's five, maybe it's 50 patients, but there is no, but it's not nearly the number that a company can actually justify building an entire program around. Some of those programs are run under this N of one umbrella. The point is that they're these trials involve patients who there are way too few in order for them to be commercialized. And that's one way of thinking about this kind of general category. I'll throw out one more idea and then I'll sort of let Olivia and Rick add on. One other concept is that if you have a trial in which the trial is really consuming most of the patient population in the world that could ever take the drug. you aren't trialing it in a few patients or maybe 100 patients with the intent to give it to tens of thousands, then some of these same design considerations come into play when your entire target population is the group that you're actually enrolling in the trial because it's so small.
Thanks, Tim. I appreciate your thoughts there. And so just to kind of summarize what I'm hearing as far as definition, a genetic treatment that is targeting that individual's specific genetic change or a small number of individuals. And generally, that small number is an amount where commercialization may be difficult. A traditional clinical trial design model may not be appropriate or feasible, are some of the defining features. And so I think within that, as a summarized definition, we're talking about really small numbers. We're talking about huge amounts of resources to be able to do these types of N of one treatments and trials. Why should we care about this? Why is this important to the larger scientific and medical community?
I'm going to jump in here, if I may. Because these patients, when we identify them, are eminently treatable in theory, but they're orphans. They're out there with no one really going from that point of diagnosis to treatment. So we've become very good at diagnosing these patients through newer genomic testing strategies, whole exome, whole genome type testing. But what's been missing is that next step to say, well, now what do we do? And unless they're part of a larger disease group where they're eligible for a traditional clinical trial, as you mentioned, Scott, they've gone by the wayside. So I think we as a community feel that we have an obligation to see if we can address a treatment strategy for them.
Yeah, and to echo Rick, and we are here for the unmet need of the really, really rare, but I think as we have more genetic testing, the numbers are going to increase even in rare disease. And so nobody really only wants to see an N of one if there is opportunity to help more patients potentially with the targeted therapeutic if the right candidate. And so, you know, that's going to be depending on the design of the therapeutic, potentially, for example, with ASOs, if it was non-allele specific versus allele specific, and based on the design, whether it was actually the variant versus a single nucleotide polymorphism. But this is where we still want to prioritize the really rare, and we start from N of one to see, because this is getting at the root cause of pathophysiology, and we should look.
I appreciate that. And it occurs to me with a maybe somewhat leading question that there are patient populations that collectively are quite common, but individually are rare enough that if we're not able to treat from this mechanism, treatments will forever not be available to them because traditional trial mechanisms are never going to fill that gap. And I to your point earlier, Olivia, that it's not just about ASOs, that seems particularly relevant for some of the technologies a little more on the horizon than ASOs like gene editing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's getting interesting, even within genes, you know, looking at the specific variants, whether it's gain or loss or mixed gain, these are kind of guiding also which type of approaches to take. But still all need to have, I think all deserve merit as to having scientific inquiry, whether you're the rarest or not.
Yeah, I might add to that too. So I think this is a really, you know, I think this line of questioning began around what isn't then a blind trial, and we've described the unique circumstances. A related topic is, you know, why do we see the need for N of one trials? And Rick, you know, your answer also kind of got at that a little bit. It's because these are really difficult trials, and if we had the option of running a standard clinical trial, you know, why would we ever try to do something this difficult and customize a trial to an individual patient? And I think that's another part of the definition or understanding what the purpose of an N of one trial is. It's that these are trials that are designed to meet the needs of patients with diseases that are too small that traditional trials don't work. We just don't have that option. And then just getting back to something that was already mentioned, but just sort of underscoring it, these medicines, we're talking about medicines for which we don't have a medicine that works for everybody with the disease. We're talking about medicines for which we have really powerful but really precise medicines, like antisense oligonucleotides, like siRNAs, like CRISPR editing. And they're incredibly powerful, they're incredibly precise, but because they're precise, they might only apply to a handful of people. So just to kind of complete that piece, you know, why would we do something difficult if you could do something traditional? Well, because the traditional approach just doesn't work.
I really appreciate that that way of sort of bringing it home, Tim. And I think it leads to the next part. So if we've been talking about sort of why to do an N of one, how should we be thinking about what types of patients are appropriate for an N of one trial? And maybe thinking about this with the lens of the neurologist, geneticist, or other provider out there who has a patient and is trying to ask themselves, should I be sending this patient to someone? Should I be thinking about an N of one? What are appropriate patients in you guys' mind?
I think one way to start the discussion here would be to address this topic as we've struggled with this within the N1 Collaborative of trying to establish some criteria and selection criteria at a disease level. So how serious does the disease need to be considered? Would we do this for something that has a modest impact on a child's growth and development and survival, or does it have to have a certain degree of severity? Secondly, there has to be a high unmet need. To say that there are no other real treatment strategies for this condition beyond supportive care, so that there's a void there. And then we have to understand, as Tim mentioned earlier, that what is the tempo of progression of disease, and is there a real chance or likelihood that we could even develop an ASO for a particular individual by the time it would have some meaningful impact? Or is the disease galloping along so quickly that in that 1 to 2 years it takes us to develop the drug and be able to deliver it to the patient, that is that child still going to be alive? So there's some practical issues that come into play. And then there's also this ethical dimension, because unlike a traditional clinical trial where we have a pretty good idea about what the risk is because it's been tested in animal models and toxicity studies reasonably extensively, that's very abbreviated here. So we're not really being able to talk to the parent or the child or adult with that is being considered for treatment to say that we have a very good idea about the safety of this particular drug. We have a general idea about ASOs, but maybe not for that specific one. Nor are we going to be able to promise any efficacy. We're going to give some hope because we think we have all the science behind this to back it up, to say, okay, we know that, let's say this ASO works in your cells in a in vitro or test tube setting, and it looks like it's doing what it's supposed to do, but we can't really guarantee that you're going to benefit from this clinically. So we need to include those discussions as well. So it's quite a bit different from a standard clinical trial. And Olivia, maybe you can elaborate on that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that come into play in terms of, you know, patient selection and who's appropriate, of course. It's got to be a variant that we are categorizing as rare, obviously, as that we've discussed. And then in terms of outcome measures that have to be tailored, is it's to your point, you know, where are we in terms of disease progression? What's the chronologic timeframe that we have? Is there an adequate natural history as a run-in baseline for us to know, is there going to be a change that's relevant? Because as we have written about, you know, outcome measures, there's so many different levels, whether we're talking about target engagement or patient-oriented outcome measures, quality of life, these things are all very important to consider. But with an end of one trial, there's a lot that comes into play to minimize variability and really assess, is the science going to play out? How does it play out? And we have to, you know, see whom. It's not easy to be in an end of one trial period as a patient or as an investigator, I would say.
Olivia, Rick did a really good job of describing really how we prioritize cases today in 2025 and being really careful about choosing conditions that, according to the criteria that they described, are that's exactly right. I want to underscore that. I'll take the easy route out, though, and I'm actually going to step back a second and say, you know, answer Scott, your question in a slightly different way. You know, who are N of one trials for? And I would say that in the future, we could imagine that N of one trials are for nearly anybody with a genetic condition. Nearly anybody with a genetic condition has a genetic change that the great majority of the time is unique or nearly unique to that patient. And so when we talk about why are we investing a lot of our energies personally and professionally into working on this space, it's because we imagine a future where the treatments, the structure of treatments that we deliver for patients will match the architecture of disease, which is there's this long, long tail of rare genetic conditions with underlying rare genetic mutations that require rare and individualized therapies. And so eventually all of this, you know, now taking the easy route out and looking like 20 years in the future, we're anticipating that this is where CRISPR will go. This is where the next, whatever will replace CRISPR will go, whatever specific genetically customized treatment will go. But in this awkward early phase, when we're just getting our feet under ourselves in the last 7 years since the first case, and then moving forward, we're being very careful about patient selection because this is new, unexplored territory with not fully defined risks, as we've described. And so choosing these cases in the way that Rick and Olivia and Scott, you described, is really paramount right now.
I really appreciate the vision aspect of this and where we're trying to go as a community and a field. Can we maybe, without getting too deep in the science, get a little bit more specific about what is scientifically possible today with what we know with antisense oligonucleotides? So which types of genes or variants would be amenable or have approaches that we know of or think about these days for development of an ASO individualized?
Okay, I'll take first crack. It just so happens that we've got Rick, Olivia, Scott. We've got a gaggle of neurologists all on this call, and they're the reason for that. The reason that this group here that has really pioneered a lot of these early N-of-1 trials is we're all neurologists, is that it turns out that the first platform that we're using to unveil N-of-1 trials into the field is antisense oligonucleotides, which have some real remarkable advantages in when used for neurologic disease. You can inject antisense oligonucleotides into the central cerebrospinal fluid, and they're broadly taken up into brain and spinal cord. If you inject them into the eye, they're also taken up broadly by neurons and other cells in the eye. So this property, this pharmacologic property, it's by chance where it's so evenly distributed and so broadly taken up, means that the patients with genetic mutations in neurologic disease genes are especially really good candidates right now. That's the first cut answer. A second cut answer is, well, what kind of mutations in those genes are appropriate? I'll take a first crack, which is that there are a couple of different types of mutations that are currently the subject of N-of-1 trials. One are mutations that cause some sort of toxic gain of function effect in the gene that makes it do something which is really bad to the patient. A missense mutation in a channel that allows it to open up too broadly and inject so much current that it makes the cell go haywire. A gene that results in misfolding and then causes poisoning to the neuron. That is an approach, that is a disease mechanism where we can develop tailored therapies that specifically go in and shut down the malfunctioning gene in a way that could be helpful. I can leave it to Rick and Olivia and you guys to talk about, to complete the answer.
Yeah, and I would say, there's most of the time it would gain or loss of function, but there's so many, it's looking at monogenic conditions, just to step back. And, even just in the context of epilepsy, there's like hundreds of monogenic epilepsies where this could be relevant. And so this is an approach that really makes sense. And it already is happening on commercial front for some of the slightly more common rare conditions. But as we, as we know, there's hundreds of them that could be amenable. So we're starting with a few that are really rare, but it could really change the paradigm of how we consider treatment of a disease, a neurologic condition that presents with autism, seizures, movement disorder delays, and regression based on one potential variant that we think would be at the root cause. And so that's the idea behind looking at, is there a change? Can we see a difference in modified protein expression one way or the other that shows a difference in phenotypic symptoms too?
I would just add that further to what you've both said, we have this patient in front of us. We know their genetic variant, but the next step in the process really is to feel very secure that we understand how that genetic variant affects cellular function. So as Tim mentioned, you can have a toxic gain of function, but there could be exactly the opposite. There could be loss of function, as Olivia mentioned. So you need to really know that for certain, because your ASO is going to be designed to modify that gene expression. So if it's a gain of function, you want to knock it down. If it's a loss of function, let's say it affects splicing, you want to be able to modify the splicing so that you can increase the amount of a deficient protein. So that's a critical next step. And I think we're getting better at being able to move forward with these. But at the moment, this is a fairly manual, laborious process. But we do have some in silico models that allow us to try to better understand the effect of a variant, as well as to help us design the ASO that we think would be both safe and effective for that particular patient with that variant.
Perfect. So maybe just to kind of keep moving through the theoretical process here, we've identified some patients. We've identified a variant that we think may be amenable to an ASO design. Now we're thinking about a clinical trial in this individual. And I'd like to try to draw some comparisons between an N of one trial and traditional clinical trials, which we're used to hearing about, reading about, knowing about, and guiding our practice as clinicians. And so those often will go through phase one, phase two, phase three, sort of stepwise progression. Ultimately, that pivotal trial as a phase three or otherwise is going to be some sort of randomized, controlled, double-blinded, gold standard trial. So rather than starting with the differences, maybe can we actually start with what's similar? How is an N of one trial similar to that traditional model of a clinical trial?
I mean, overall, in terms of looking at clinical trials, they're going to need the same overall framework for a clinical trial in terms of looking at identifying a candidate to include as their subject, and looking at are they amenable or not to drug, and then looking at standard clinical outcome trial setup in terms of defining your safety measures, your outcome assessments, efficacy assessments, and looking at stopping rules, et cetera. And so the overall arch and theme is the same. It's just modifying those measures and what is relevant to an individual.
And I would add that we still need to go through the process of taking a lead candidate ASO for this patient with this variant and doing some toxicology studies and then preparing a package to submit to the FDA in what's currently called a single patient IND or investigational new drug application. And it still has to get approved by the FDA. And then we have to still get informed consent from the patient or their parent because this is an investigational drug. So it has many of the same similarities. And then when we're treating the patient, we still need to capture safety data. We still need to get efficacy data. And as Olivia said, we need to think about stopping rules and things that would be common in a larger clinical trial. The challenges are that you're dealing with one patient, not a whole group. So you can't really power this the way you would to statistically answer something. So you need to sort of bake in to the study design here. How do you define success? And what does that look like with regards to clinical outcome assessments and response? So there are many similarities, but how, for example, we use an outcome measure might be very different here than in a standard clinical trial where you're trying to show something statistically.
Yeah, and continuing on the theme of similarities, I think really an N of one trial addresses exactly all of the same scientific and clinical questions that are important in a phase one, a phase two, and a phase three trial. It's just that it's all compressed into one. We have to first find out, we have to explore the safety of the drug. We have to explore the safety at different doses. We have to confirm the bioavailability or the distribution or the pharmacokinetics of the drug as best as we can. And then we need to begin to explore efficacy using both patient-reported, certainly patient-relevant, and then clinically objective measures. So if let us not pretend that it's a completely different beast. It's just the challenges of trying to compress as much of a traditional phase 1, 2, 3 design considerations into the constraints of a very, very small package.
I appreciate that. And anchoring to how this is similar helps us to say, like, we're not coming up with something that's totally crazy and unknown. There already is an existing framework that we can lean on in terms of how we run trials as a whole. Then to shift gears a little bit, and Rick, you kind of started to talk about this some, but what are some of the important differences and how do we then adjust for it?
Not to put you on the spot or anything, Rick.
Well, Scott, that's an important question. I think part of the difficulty in answering it is that we're really defining a new field of medicine, and it's not been fully developed yet. So we're learning as we go, and we're trying to be particularly cautious and to be smart in the decisions we make, because everything we do is going to build upon what's come before and hopefully help with designing future N of ones. So I think what's different here is just starting with how do you select the disease and of interest? How do you select which variants are amenable? How do you say that whether an ASO is the right way to go versus looking at maybe an AAV gene transfer approach or a CRISPR or other technology that might evolve, as Tim mentioned earlier? So we have to answer some very sort of fundamental questions. But once we get to that point, as I said earlier, we need to make sure we understand the mechanism of disease, how that gene affects it. I think for a standard clinical trial, you don't necessarily need to know that. If you have a small molecule drug and you're trying to treat something like hypertension or diabetes or even genetic diseases, it may not be a gene-targeted treatment where you necessarily need to know the mechanism of action as thoroughly as we do here. But that's I think, maybe a critical difference. And then we also need to have ideally some biomarkers that help us give an early readout. Is the drug doing what it's supposed to do when we treat a patient? Does it increase a protein or knock it down? And can we measure that? Because we're not really sure when we're going to see a clinical response or if we're going to see one and what that might look like, because these are entirely new endeavors. So we're more relying on biomarker responses, at least early on in the treatment with these ASOs, to try to give us a sense that we're following an informative path that hopefully will help the patient and we should keep going. So those would be, I think, just a couple of examples of where this might be different from a traditional clinical trial. I think, finally, I would add that we're not going to be able to statistically prove anything. We're not going to say, okay, we had a p-value or we had a comparator control group, because in many cases, the natural history of these ultra-rare disorders is not well-defined. So we have to look at the patient as her or his own control and look at that run-in period and change in trajectories. So that requires a whole different statistical approach to how do you try to identify a change for better or worse. And that's where new types of statistics, such as Bayesian modeling and things like that, are being considered.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I wonder if I could probe just a little bit on something else that was mentioned. Olivia, you mentioned that discontinuation criteria. Well, in a traditional clinical trial, you have participants within that trial, and some may choose to continue and some will drop out of the trial and choose not to continue with it. You also have a trial discontinuation criteria, which is to say we have a safety concern and we're going to stop the trial, for example. As Tim mentioned, that's all kind of compressed within one. And that really kind of comes down to this idea of like continuation, discontinuation. How do we set that up within an N of one? And how do you think about that with the family or patient that's participating? And what are those criteria like for a continuation or discontinuation in an N of one?
Yeah, I think these are extremely important things to address and consider before you start the trial. And it's going to be part of informed consent to know this. These are things that we may or may not see and have some anticipatory guidance there in terms of looking at, you know, we're trying to standardize and make it as, consistent as possible within trial with a single patient. And so a lot of the things that we're trying to do to make it a little bit more standardized is to look at biomarkers, whether there's target engagement. That's a challenge, but obviously that would be ideal. And then safety assessments, depending on, I mean, we're pretty much talking about neurologic diseases. And so there's certain things that we would want to look out for in terms of known potential adverse effects related to ASO specific or serious adverse events. So these are things that you would have to monitor closely during the trial and have, and the one difference also with N of one trials, very different from standard clinical trials, is the amount of data sharing that's already happening as we're in trial, because we're all kind of trying to inform and help the process in this new space. And so I think that's bringing about more opportunity for collaborations or discussions that's a little bit different from your standard industry trials, where you don't really hear about things until the end. But I think that's actually galvanizing more trials and more interest and opportunity for inquiry.
You made a very important point there, Olivia, about data sharing, and I just want to elaborate on that, if I may. In a standard clinical trial run by a pharmaceutical company, that data is kept very it's very closely held within the company, and positive trials are published and negative trials, sometimes that data just sort of disappears. Here, I think the N of one community is feeling strongly that we need to share data so that jointly we can learn from each other's experiences, both positive and negative, what's working and what isn't. So there's a very different sense of obligation almost of saying that as we enter into this new field of medicine, we need to be sharing our data and our experiences to try to give everyone the best chance for success.
Wonderful points. I was going to now see, I know that there's been some efforts within the N of One Collaborative to try to build towards some standardization of these approaches. And I was wondering if, Olivia, maybe you could expand a little bit on kind of how the N1C is approaching this, and if you have any specific examples where we're trying to help guide investigators in terms of how they think about and approach these trials.
Yeah, I think it's N1C has been having a really important role in this space, just because we're publishing a lot and kind of discussing and making this more readily available on multiple media platforms. And so I think there's a lot of interest, and I think it's important to inform that, you know, it's not that easy to take off, but there's certain steps that we're trying to make it work. For example, with outcome measures and the effort for creating a more, you know, a database of outcome measures that are current ongoing, and you know, that could be useful for future considerations if you are thinking about an N of one trial. I think this would be things that we are learning as we are going through the process. And, you know, certain things like even neurodevelopmental measures, as one example, where you may not be using your standard outcome measures because they're not able to do typical outcome assessments with a standard Bayley for. And so you might be using GSDs, and this is kind of across the board with a lot of neurodevelopmental conditions and neurodegenerative conditions in young kids who may be less verbal or cognitively impaired. And so these kind of things are things that we're learning as we go through the process. And I think it's really important to articulate to others who may be interested in wanting to get into this space, because we want it to be standardized and rigorous and maintain structure as we proceed forward. And it shouldn't be one-offs here and there, I believe.
Absolutely. Rick or Tim, anything to add to that?
Well, I'll go ahead and shamelessly plug one of Olivia's efforts in the space, leading a manuscript that outlines the problem. I think the title is A Framework for N-of-1 Clinical Trials. It was published in Nature Communications just a few months ago. Olivia, maybe you could point out to folks the reference more specifically. That is one of the work products of the N-of-1 Collaborative that is helping to define the problem. There's an accompanying and slightly shorter version that Rick, myself, and Erica Augustine penned in JAMA, published also just a few months ago, that we can refer people to. But I think, no, this is a space which is in the early days, but by early, it's not even necessarily even that early yet. In the U.S., there have been almost 30 cases that have advanced. And so one of the real pushes that we managed to get agreement and momentum around is the sharing of the clinical trial designs amongst investigators through meetings and regular conversations between all of us. What we'd like to do is formalize that and actually build a repository where those protocols might be shared. And we are working towards the even sort of more granular levels of pulling clinical trial associated artifacts like clinical research forms that we can pull together and build a library upon which people can then just pull their favorite form from the library and then use that to help harmonize designs across different sites. At Children's, we happen to have run about half a dozen of these trials, and so we've taken our forms and pitched them in, as well as contributed a database of outcomes from our trials that is consented for sharing amongst the group. And we're hoping to build off of that kind of nucleus to get all of this right.
Tim, and I would add that. The N1 Collaborative really is a collaborative effort. It's trying to build a community, and there within the N1C are different working groups trying to address different topics, such as patient selection criteria. It would be one example. Others that have to do with more granular aspects of ASO design and how do you determine safety and how do you look at demonstrating efficacy and manufacturing issues. So we're basically trying to deconstruct the whole process into these different building blocks and having very open forums and discussions that's international in nature. To my mind, those have been highly effective in trying to galvanize the community and sort of work towards developing some sort of standard that might be applied more broadly.
I had one other topic that I wanted to touch on, and Tim, I'm going to put you on the spot here before we maybe give everybody to give some thoughts. You've done some I think very nice work in trying to think creatively around one of the challenges that's a bit more unique to an NF1, which is the risk of a sense of coercion within an N-of-1 trial. In a traditional trial, if an individual chooses not to participate, it doesn't mean that you don't have a trial. But that is the case in an N-of-1. And could you maybe tell us a little bit about how you guys have been thinking about this institutionally and even specifically around your consent monitoring concept and how you're trying to support families as they make these challenging decisions?
Oh, thanks a ton, Scott. Yeah, thanks for pointing. This is a really sensitive subject, and like sort of illustrates some of the unique challenges. So, right, in a standard clinical trial, research participants are clearly research participants that are contributing to knowledge towards a disease, and that they may care very passionately about. But as you say, the trial will go on with or without any individual participants' involvement. And so there is a sense of it's a safe decision, right? If a family were to decide to withdraw from a trial, then they would have, obviously, every right to do so. But then there wouldn't be this sort of sense of, there's the possibility of a sense in an N-of-1 trial that they might be letting a team down, right? And on this point, I think that the conversation to launch a trial is one that we really take the partnership with the family very, very seriously. And we make sure to make clear from the outset that the point of this trial is to compassionately benefit the patient. But we make it and underscore the fact that at any given point that we're optimizing to the patient. And if their needs change and their participation doesn't make any sense anymore, then that really is paramount. We use a variety of just communication techniques, We just talk a lot to the families about the subject well in advance and stay very close to them through the whole process, through all the ups and downs. We, in our consent process, right, we never think of our consent as a single point in time where we sign a document and now you're locked in. Through that process of engagement, we promise them and warn them up in advance that we'll be coming back to them often to see if their continued participation continues to make sense for them or not. Sometimes it's them saying that it's time to stop. Maybe it's us who feel at some point that it's futile and or something's not going well and we think it's time to stop, but we prep for all of that in advance. Those are tricky conversations. Not unfamiliar to those running traditional trials, but the ante is up a little bit. We use an independent from our team. We have a consent monitor that comes in and follows up any conversations we have on the families at these critical junctures to, usually with a couple of days lag so that they have some time to reflect and think and to think questions that they might have had since our last discussion. And those consent monitors help make sure that families have all their questions answered and have their concerns or any new concerns addressed. It gives us a lot of sense of safety as investigators that we're doing the right thing when we have that extra suspender in addition to the belt to make sure things are going right.
Thanks, Tim. And I just really appreciate the thoughtfulness and consideration that brings as an approach to this sort of scenario. So thanks for outlining that a little bit for everybody. Olivia first, then Rick. We're maybe 30 seconds each if you have any final closing remarks or thoughts that on things that we didn't cover.
I just think it's a very exciting and interesting time for us to be able to consider this even as an option for science and relevance to our patients. And so there's some specific major challenges that do require a lot of collaboration, you know, regulatory, academia, et cetera. And so, but I think that, you know, I'm excited to see how things move forward so that we can see what we can do for our patients with their diseases.
And from my perspective, this is particularly complicated because we're trying to develop a treatment for a particular patient or a small number of patients, but we're learning as we go. It's not like a final structured program yet. So I feel that through the N1C, I'm given a lot of tools and support and expertise of others that can help guide me through this process. I would be personally uncomfortable trying to go through this alone. And I think just having, again, the N1 collaborative to to provide the support and the information and the critical reviews of these different topics gives me great comfort in trying to pursue this and try to do the best thing we can for our patients.
That comment totally resonates with me, and I echo it, Rick. So I very much appreciate that. And just to close, I want to thank Nicole and the N-of-1 Collaborative for hosting us for this fireside chat. Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Olivia. Thank you, Tim, for participating and for your incredibly thoughtful comments and discussion.